Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Everybody, and I do hope that you've been enjoying your week so far. I hope it's been a great 2018 for you thus far. 2018's already feeling like it's going to be a great year, and another great year in the history of the Bareback Facts. But for all you new listeners out there, I'd like to remind you all that we have a call-in number at 718-508-9883. And for those of you who've been with me since the beginning, welcome back, baby. We're here again. And today we're taking it back to some of the old material that I used to look at when I first started the show. Now, keep in mind, this is not old material for those of you that are new listeners, nor is it really old material per se for those of you who are have been here for a while. When I say old material, I mean some of the things that were kind of the roots of this show near the beginning. Mythology, religion, themes that we covered before. Well, we're bringing it back today. We're kicking it old school. Today, I'm bringing back another segment on mythology, and we're talking about the legendary tragic hero, Diarmuid, from Irish and Celtic mythology. Now, Diarmuid is a fascinating individual who comes out of the Celtic mythos. He's part of the Fenian cycle of Irish mythology, which is traditionally set in the 2nd to 4th century, and is best known as being the lover of the intended wife, Finn McCool, in the legend The Pursuit of Diarmuid and Gronn. Now, Gronn is a bit of a odd little character herself. She's basically an earlier Guinevere to an extent, and we'll get into where we kind of get a little bit of Guinevere out of her. And I should say we're not really getting Guinevere out of her, because Guinevere is in part almost inspired by her character. And when we start talking a little bit more about Diarmuid as we move forward, you're going to understand why. So Diarmuid O'Dina, who's also just known as Diarmuid of the Love Spot, another very curious name, to say the least, was the son of an Irishman named Don, and was one of the Fianna in the Fenian cycle of Irish mythology. Now, for those of you not familiar with the Fian or Fianna, they were a small, semi-independent warrior band. That's the term for small, semi-independent warrior bands that existed in Irish myth. They're featured in stories of the Fenian cycle, where they are led by Finn McCool. They are based on historical bands of aristocratic, landless young men in early medieval Ireland. So, a little bit of a crash course in that for you. Now, in the legend, the Tuatha De Danann, god of love and creativity, Angus Og, who is a member of the Tuatha De Danann. Specifically, the Tuatha De Danann, for those of you not in the know about Irish myth, the name itself, Tuatha De, means tribe of gods, and they are of the Danu, or Dana, the goddess Dana, or Danu. It usually translates as people or tribes of Dana. They are a supernatural race of gods in Irish myth, and they are thought to represent the main deities of pre-Christian Gaelic Ireland. And among them are the god Lu, the more popular and more familiar, the Morrigan, and Angus, and a number of other gods, all who have their own sort of things going on. They all have, and then of course there's also Nuada and a number of other gods who appear in the stories. The Morrigan happens to be probably the most popular, one of the more widely worshipped Celtic gods and of the Celtic gods and goddesses. She's more of a less a figure of chaos and violence, and she appears quite prominently in the myths. But Angus was Diarmuid's foster father and protector. He is the god of love and creativity, and according to the story of Diarmuid, Diarmuid was a skilled warrior, well-liked, and was a valued member of the Fian, who single-handedly held off an entire army, Cool, and the band by himself, which we'll get into that as well. Now, the god Angus Og owned a deadly sword named Moraltok, or Noraltok. It's roughly translated out of Old Celtic. The name of the weapon is roughly translated to the Great Fury. This is given to him by the sea god Menen Makalur, the son of the sea. And Moraltok was said to leave no stroke or blow unfinished at the first trial. So basically, if you're hit with Moraltok, you die instantly. It's a one-shot kill. It's a one-hitter quitter. The ultimate haymaker of haymakers in the ancient world. Angus gave this sword to Diarmuid in addition to a sword named Bagaltok, which means the Little Fury. Now, along with these two swords, Diarmuid is known to have wielded two spears. One was known as the Gaebuid, which is the yellow spear, and the other known as the Gaedirg, which caused wounds that could not be healed. Now, the red spear which he bore was said to bear a poison that would never allow your wounds, any wounds you sustained with it would never heal. He used Gaedirg and Moraltok for adventures, which were matters of life and death. So he used the red spear and, of course, the Great Fury for adventures that were life and death matters. And he used the other two weapons, the Little Fury and the Yellow Spear, for lesser battles. So basically, he is one of the only heroes to have a second string set of weapons and a first string set of weapons, where he actually feels like, I might die in this battle, so I'm going to bring my best weapons with me. But if I don't think I'm going to die and I'm not going to take this too seriously, I'm going to put the second string in, which I find very humorous. Now we get into his curse. See, Diarmuid, like many great warriors in ancient mythology, he wouldn't be much of a hero if there wasn't a conflict for him to face. And he also wouldn't be much of a hero if he didn't die. Something we'll also be talking about in this segment is why it's important that heroes die. So, at least in the context of mythology, and I'll explain why that is towards the end of the show. Now, Diarmuid's father was a warrior as well of the Fian, and at a dinner party, Don was jealous of the attention given to the son of Angus's steward. So, in response, when no one was looking, he killed the steward's son, Congus, and Angus, the god, resurrected the steward's son in the form of a boar. But the steward required Finn to find out the truth, and upon learning the truth, he put a curse upon Diarmuid. He was to be killed by the boar that the steward's son was transformed into. So, through no fault of his own, Diarmuid is cursed because of his father's jealousy and stupidity. He gets cursed, and he has to carry this curse on his back throughout his entire life. So he doesn't know when he's going to die, but he knows exactly what will kill him. In addition to that, he's also cursed with two other things. He has to make a geese with this god. His father has made a geese in his place. Now, if you don't know what a geese is, this is an oath, an unbreakable vow that must be made. And if you break this vow, you die. This is said to be this is almost like a magical connection that's established. It's almost the equivalent of a blood oath, but through magic. Diarmuid's father is forced into making a geese with the god Angus. And this word bond that he has to make is that Dearmude cannot kill a boar. He cannot strike a deadly blow at a boar. He also cannot eat boar meat. And he cannot defend against a boar's he cannot defend against a boar. And this is going to come back to bite him in the apt and later. Now, is his beauty, excuse me, he's said to be incredibly beautiful, and he has this spot on his head called the love spot. This spot makes him irresistible to ladies, and while hunting one night, he meets a woman who was the personification of youth. After sleeping with him, she put a magical love spot on his forehead that caused any woman who looked upon him to fall in love with him. This is also going to come back to bite him in the rear. So Dearmude is actually, as you see early on in his life, is just having things kind of happen to him as a consequence of the things that people around him are doing. So he's having really no say in all these things. They're just happening. and it is here in which we enter the loathly lady and the cup. This is another story involving Dearmude. It's on one freezing winter's night, a loathly lady entered the Fionn's lodge where the warriors had just gone to bed after a hunting expedition. Drenched to the bone, her wet hair was snarled and knotted. She knelt beside each warrior and demanded from them a blanket, beginning with Finn. None of them were down to help the lady out. She got to the youngest, which was Dearmude, whose bed was nearest to the fireplace, and only he took pity on her, giving her not only his blanket, but his bed. In the instant that he does so, she notices his love spot and says that she wandered the world alone for 7 years. Dearmude told her that she could sleep all night and he would protect her. Now, towards dawn, she wakes again. And instead of being an old, snarled, and ugly-looking lady that she was when she came in, all of a sudden she's beautiful, she's hot, she's beauty and grace, but not Miss United States. She's just hot. The next day, she rewards Dearmude's kindness by offering him his greatest wish, a house overlooking the sea. Now, overjoyed, Dearmude asks the woman to live with him. She agrees on one condition. He must promise never to mention how ugly she looked, grows restless. She offers to watch his hound and her new pups while Dearmude goes hunting, because he wants to go out and do what boys do, run around and hunt. On three separate occasions, Dearmude's friends, envious of his luck, visit the lady and ask for one of the new pups. Each time she honors the request, each time Dearmude was angry and asked her how she could repay him so meanly when he overlooked her ugliness the first night that they met. Now, on the third mention, the woman and the house disappeared and his beloved greyhound dies. So he stupidly breaks the deal with her. Now, realizing that his ungratefulness has caused him to lose everything that he valued, Dearmude sets out to find his lady. He uses an enchanted ship to cross a stormy sea to the other world. And if you're not familiar with the other world in the context of Celtic mythology, the other world is the realm of fairies and the realm of gods, demons and monsters and all sorts of fancy, fun stuff. So this is not a easy journey by any stretch of the imagination. The other world is a treacherous place. People lose their minds. They lose track of time. You could be lost there for thousands of years and come back, and everybody that you know is dead. There are numerous stories in Celtic myth involving the treachery and dangers of the other world. But nonetheless, he enters in undaunted. He enters the other world, and he searches for the lady through meadows filled with brightly colored horses and silver trees. And three times he sees a drop of blood. He gathers each drop into his handkerchief. Now, when a stranger reveals that the king's gravely ill daughter had just returned after 7 years, Dearmude realized that it must be his lady. Rushing to her side, he discovers that she was dying. The three drops of blood Dearmuid collected were from her heart, spilled each time that she thought of Dearmuid. The only cure was a cup of healing water from the Plain of Wonder, which was guarded by a jealous king and his army. Dearmuid vows to bring back the cup. After making this vow and oaths to every god imaginable, Dearmuid, Plain of Wonder, to retrieve the cup. He reaches an impassable river, and at this river, Dearmuid is helped by the red man of all knowledge, who had red hair and eyes like glowing coals. He helps Dearmuid to cross the river, and guides him to the king of the Healing Cup's country. Dearmuid calls out that the cup should be sent out from the king's castle to him, or else champions to fight with him should be sent out. And it is here that we see a very intriguing, very dangerous new conflict. So for those of you familiar with how combat is conducted in the early Middle Ages, and or how combat was conducted even in the ancient times, there is a tradition of knights and great warriors fighting champions. Kings don't fight in the Middle Ages. They don't go out and fight. They have champions. They have guys whose sole purpose in life is to wait till somebody comes over to the house to piss off their king so that they can kick their ass. So really, it can be quite good to be king, because you can have a bunch of ass kickers just laying around ready somebody in the dirt for you. Now, Dearmuid knows this, and he's only one man, but he comes to this kingdom, and he could be, now, there's no obligation except, you know, personal honor that anybody come out and fight him. They could ignore him at the gates. They could shoot him. But this is a story, and at this point in the story, people know who Dearmuid is. And this is very important, because in these stories, we can get a little bit about what is valued in these cultures and what they tell us about the society that's cultivating these stories, that's creating them. It tells us about their culture, and it tells us what they valued. And it also gives us a little bit of insight into how things were done, expectations. We don't tell stories. People didn't tell stories like this at this time only for amusement. They also taught lessons, and they also told, you know, sort of expectations about how things were supposed to be conducted. Now, Dearmuid arrives at this kingdom, and he arrives outside the walls of this castle and demands that a champion come out and fight him. He knows that the king's got an army, but he wants to fight the best guy on deck. I do apologize. I'm just getting over being sick. Excuse me again. But he knows that there's an army, but he is counting on the goodwill of this lord to honor his request. The thought was that if you're a great enough warrior, you can call out somebody. People didn't want to waste good warriors. You don't want to waste your whole army. You also don't want warriors to just die for no reason, and you don't want to incur the wrath of other kingdoms and other noblemen. This was very important. Somebody's man-at-arms through treachery. If people saw you as a dishonorable person, it was harder to make peace with people. It was harder to get out of situations that were unfavorable to you, and it was also harder to get people to side with you and help you out if somebody should attack you, because they didn't want to be associated with somebody they thought was dishonorable. And this is very important in terms of establishing why Dearmuid is able to come up to this castle and basically call out a champion. Because he's in that social standing that he can do that. But the king is not having it. He's not going to send out a champion to fight Dearmuid. Instead of sending out a champion to fight Dearmuid, he decides that he's going to do something different. He not only knows who Dearmuid is, one man's going to be able enough to do the job. So instead, on two separate occasions, he sends out 800 warriors to kill Dearmuid. Each time, Dearmuth killed every single one of them. In 3 hours' time, there is not a single man left to stand against him. So in 3 hours, he killed 1,600 men by himself, single-handedly. This is a tremendous feat. After this, the king says, well, 1,600 wasn't enough. Time to step it up. He then sends out two contingents of 900 better fighters who are sent out to kill Dearmuth. So he sends out the first string, 1,600, two battalions of 800 men, and Dearmuth kills them in 3 hours. Puts them all down like grass. He figured, the king says, well, that didn't work. Oh, now I just lost 1,600 guys. They're all dead. So now I'm going to send the best 1,800 guys that I got. So he sends out another two waves of 900 guys this time. And within 4 hours, Dearmuth kills every single one of them as well. After this, Dearmuth comes up to the castle, and he knocks one more time and says, all right, I just killed 3,400 people. Give me that cup. The king thinks it over and decides that instead of sending out more men, he's going to give them the cup. So he gives them the cup of healing, and on the return trip, man whom Dearmuth has met before advises Dearmuth on how to heal his lady. He also warns the hero that when her sickness ended, Dearmuth's love for her would also end as well. So he tells Dearmuth that, yes, you'll be able to heal her, and this is how you do it. But once you do, you won't be in love with her anymore. But Dearmuth doesn't think about his own personal feelings or his own gain. He realizes that he's going to be without a lady now. He returns to the other king, enters her bedchamber. He gives her the cup of healing, and having cured her, he departs. Dearmuth boards an enchanted ship and returns to the Fion, where he's greeted by his friends and his greyhound, which the lady had returned to life as her final gift to him. Now, guys, before we continue on with more stories of Dearmuth and his ultimate fate, we're going to take a commercial break. And here at Totally Driven Entertainment, we've got a proud new sponsor. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. You're going to want to check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com for all of his content. He's doing some very entertaining things over there at his website. Very comedic stuff, guys. So, see you guys after the break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Dearmuth and Grian.
I'm Black Man. Saving man's eye, one stereotype at a time.
To the Black Mobile. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
All right, everybody. Thank you for holding out for the break. Welcome back to the show. Before you guys left, we're talking about Dear Mude's experience with the Loathly Lady in the Cup. And now we get to the pursuit of Dear Mude and Gron. And for those of you not familiar with this story, it's the surviving text of the pursuit is dated no earlier than the 17th century. But even so, there's a reference to the tale in the 12th century manuscript, the Book of Leinster, which gives it some staying power. It shows that it's been around for a very long time. Even if there is only reference to it in that book, it's still a pretty old story. And it's a popular romance of a love triangle. So Finn McCool, who's much older than in his other adventures, at this point he's been around the block a number of times, had a number of wives over the years. And when his last wife died, his son Oisin and his companions one day asked Finn when he would remarry. One of the other warriors, Deer Ruing, suggested that the best woman for Finn would be Grain. She's the daughter of a very prominent individual, the High King of Ireland. Yes, he's the guy that's running the place. Now, they thought that she thought she would be remarrying Finn's son, or his grandson, Oscar, not the aging Finn himself. So he arrives to collect this woman, and they talk it over dinner, and the king's like, yeah, my daughter, Finn, you're awesome. Yeah, dude, you're whatever. You're my guy. You're the guy that's been killing people for me all these years. Sure, you're 60 or whatever. I know my daughter's only like 15, 16 years old, but you know what? It's the Middle Ages. Who's counting? Let's do this. So, to be her grandfather, which would be pretty disappointing. If your new fiancé is old enough to be your grandpa, you probably don't want them as your new fiancé or fiance. Let's get it right, Dallas. So she's not happy about this. Fiancé. She's determined not to marry Finn. And decides that instead of marrying Finn, she's going to run away with one of the champions. Now, she administered drugs into the line of the guests, except for Poison, Oscar, Dearmude, Kyle, and DeRuing. These are the youngest guys in the band of warriors that came with Finn, and apparently they're the best-looking dudes. She's determined that she's going to run away with one of these guys. And she approaches them while everybody else is asleep, and she approaches Oisin first, and he says, no, that's not going to happen. My dad's here to marry you. That just wouldn't be right. And so then she approaches Dearmude. Now, Dearmude also objects to her advances because Finn was his best friend and also his leader, and he didn't want to cross him. But Grayen imposes a geese on Dearmude that he must follow her, basically forcing him into this magical agreement. It's essentially a spell that prohibits an obligate and it prohibits some action. It can also be a vow. Tends to be a taboo, whether of obligation or prohibition. And like I said earlier, it's almost an oath. You've got to do this now. And you see this in the knight's tales we see, the Arthurian legends. Once these guys make an oath, they've got to go through with it to the end. So she forces him into following her. Now his friends are saddened because they know that Dearmude would die if he came between Finn and his desired wife. So these guys are all the creme de la creme. They're the best warriors alive at this time. Finn is their leader, and they know that if, as good as Dearmude is, if he has to fight all these guys, there's probably a good chance that Dearmude's going to die. He's an old guy, but he's still a badass. And his band of warriors that he's been traveling with are all tough guys. So they know that this is a bad day in the clique right now. So Dearmude leaves the palace knowing that despite being a friend and close companion to Finn, that his leader's going to hunt him down for betrayal. He knows that now, even though he's compelled to do this, he knows that he's doing the wrong thing. Even if he is being compelled to do it, he knows Finn's not going to hear it. He's going to say, I got betrayed. This guy ran off with my girl, and now I got to kill him. So, of course, Finn wakes up and he sends Clan O'Naven to track down the fleeing couple. Dearmude and Grayen cross Athlone and hide in the wood of two tents. Dearmude's friends, Oisin, Oscar, Kyle, and Deering were troubled by Finn's behavior and determined to secretly help Dearmude whenever they can. So this becomes a bit of a tug of war between everybody involved, between his own companion, his former companions, and his former leader, all to keep him safe and keep him out of harm's way. Now, in the Wood of Two Tents, Dearmude had, no pun intended, erected a fence around him and Grayen with seven doorways leading to different directions in the wood. Finn told his followers to surround and capture Dearmude. Each of them offered to let the lovers through, but Dearmude refused to allow them to compromise their honor by doing so. So he goes to each door, he opens the door, and these guys are waiting for him, and they say, listen, man, we don't want to kill you. You're our buddy. You're our home slice. You're the guy that we've been hanging out with all this time. We've been drinking together. We've killed people together. We don't want to kill you. You're our brother, man. We love you. Just go on through. And Dearmude says, no, I'm not going to. My honor might be besmirched. I might be forced into this situation that I don't want to be in, but I'm not going to let you just let me go. Foolishly, I might add, he should have just let them, you know, he should have just took off, but Dearmude is too noble for that to happen. He's just not going to let it happen. He says, no, I don't want you guys to get disrespected. I don't want to compromise your honor. I'm going to stay right here. I'm going to tell them, you know, and if anybody asks me, I'm just going to tell them you guys wouldn't let me go. Now, Dearmude's father, the god, you know, foster father, Angus, the god, and his protector wanted to help him out. But Dearmude insists that he will leave on his own when he is ready. So Angus takes Grayen away to the Wood of Two Sallows, and Dearmude escapes by using his spear to vault over the fence and escape into the woods. Now, in the center of the forest of Dubros were magical berries from the Rowan Tree. Excuse me again. I'm sorry, guys. These magical berries could restore the youth of an old person guarded by the giant Sirpan on the instructions of the gods themselves. Now, this is where things get pretty crazy again. Dearmute and Grine, they arrive at this tree where these berries are being kept, and they ask Sirpan if they can live and hunt game in the forest. And to this, Sirpan says, yeah, sure, you can do that. There's only one rule. Don't eat any of these berries, because the gods don't want humans to have them. They're not for you. To keep the gods looking fresh and sexy, and the gods don't want to share. So stay away from this tree, and everything else is cool. You can kill anything you want out there, but stay away from this tree. Of course, Grain, being the ungrateful little hussy that she is, demands to have these berries as soon as this giant is gone. And she pesters Dearmude to do it. Now, Dearmude decides to come and approach Sirpan and say, listen, Sirpan, get this chick off my back. Just give us some of the dang berries and we'll get the hell out of your hair. Sirpan says, that ain't happening. A fight ensues, and Dearmude has to defend himself against this giant who's sporting a massive club the size of a tree. So, in the end, Dearmute, being a beast, kills the giant with a tree. Very impressive, if I do say so myself. I'm pretty impressed by it. He then climbs up the tree and takes Grain up there so that they can have some, so she can have some berries, and so that she'll shut up. Finn then gathers the Fian, and they travel to the wood where he had a vigil board set up, and he plays his son Oisin. Now, for those of you wondering what that is, it's basically a strategical game. It's basically their equivalent of chess. Now, Oscar and Kyle are assisting Oisin in the game since no one except Dearmude is a match against Finn. So they're playing under the same tree where apparently there's a dead giant lying around and nobody notices it. Nobody's like, hey, there's a dead giant over here. They just sit down. They're tired of chasing Finn, or they're tired of chasing Dearmude. They decide they're going to have a friendly game of chess. And the only person that's ever beaten Finn in the game of chess is Dearmute, of course. Dearmute's awesome. Just does whatever he wants, whatever he wants. Now, Dearmute's watching these guys play chess, and he just can't resist. He just cannot resist aiding Oisin in the game. So, as he watches them play this game, he begins tossing berries at the pieces to tell Oisin which pieces to move and to which spots to move. And as a consequence, Finn loses three consecutive matches to his son, whom he'd never lost to before. Now, Finn realizes that at this point, there's only one guy who knows how I play this game and knows how to beat me, and that's Dearmude. And he looks up and he realizes that Dearmude's been up there with his girlfriend the whole time. So he orders his men to kill Dearmude. The result is that Dearmute kills seven warriors named Garb. Oscar, who's Finn's grandson, warns that anyone who harmed Dearmute would face his anger and escorts the couple away through the forest. So Oscar just undercuts Finn's rules and lets Dearmute go. He helps him get away. Finn then goes to the Land of Promise to ask his old nurse, Bodmel, to kill Dearmude. As Dearmude is hunting in the forest beside the River Boyne, and Bodmal flies through the air on a flying water lily and hurls poisonous darts that can penetrate his shield and armor at him. As a consequence, Dearmude suffers incredible agony where the darts strike him, but he kills her with the red spear. So he survives, but he ends up killing her. So Finn sends this person on an errand to kill somebody he's been trying to kill the entire time, Dearmude, and it doesn't work out. And Finn is incredibly pissed when he finds out that it doesn't work out. Now, it takes the intercession on the part of the god of love, Angus, Og, coming down basically from the heavens to tell Finn, hey, listen, enough's enough. A lot of people are going to die if you keep this crap up. So here's the thing. I'm coming. I'm stepping in. All right. You're going to make peace. You're going to like it. You're going to be friends again. It's cool. Now, Finn and Dearmute and Grian live in peace at Seas Shorin in Sligo for several years. They have 5 children, 4 sons and a daughter. And here, Dearmute builds a Fort Rothgranian. However, they go for years without visiting Grian's father, Cormac McCart, and Dearmute's former comrades. And Grian persuades Dearmute to invite their friends and relations to a feast, including Finn and the Fian. Finn invited Dearmute on a boar hunt at this time, and it's pretty clear where this is going. So after inviting them to the feast, Dearmute's been living in peace this whole time. He's been minding his own business. Everybody else is gone. There's nobody's bothering him anymore. This god came out of the heavens, made peace for him, and his wife has to stir up some trouble. Because that's what she does. She stirs the pot. Now, she says, go ahead, invite all of our friends. We're going to have a feast. Life's good. Let's invite these guys. Finn's probably forgiven you for stealing me away, even though I forced you to take me out of here. He's probably forgiven you. Bring him and his warriors on over, and we're going to make sure the hatchet's right buried. Now, Finn invites Dearmute on a boar hunt on the heath of Ben Gulbane. And because of this, because this is sort of like a lowly errand in Dearmute's mind, he takes his short sword, Begaltok, and his yellow spear with him, which are not his best weapons. Now, because of this, we know that, and Finn knows, that Dearmute is not prepared to take on a big boar. But he's especially not, he's not supposed to kill boars, and he's also not able to protect himself against boars from goring him. Remember that he's cursed. He was cursed at the beginning of our tale that the boar that killed, that his father, he caused that man to be shapeshifted into a boar, and because of that, that boar was destined to kill him. Now, they went on this hunt, and he's gored by a giant boar, which had already killed a number of men and hounds. This boar was deranged, and it killed everybody in their party except for him and Finn, which it gored gored Dearmute right to the chest because his weapons couldn't fend it off, and because he was destined to get wrecked by this pig. This does not sound good in any shape or form, but it is what it is. Now, in stories involving Finn McCool, there is legend that water drunk from Finn's hands had the power of healing because he had a magical thumb. So if he fetched water, he could heal you if he drank it. Now, Finn says, oh my gosh, Dearmute got hurt. Dearmute says, hey man, that if I drink water from your cupped hands, I can be healed. And Finn says, oh yeah, that's right. And he runs off and he dips his hands into the river once and he says, you know what? That Dearmute is kind of a douchebag. Took my girlfriend from me before I could get her. That chick was hot. She could have been my wife. She's supposed to be my wife. I'm not going to do this. And he drops the water, and then he thinks about it again, and he says, you know what? Dearmute, though, he was a good guy for years. He was really serviceable. He helped me out, got me through a lot of tough times. Heck, the guy killed a bunch of guys for me, protected me. I better get that water. I don't want this to run back. But then he says, then as he starts walking that way, he lets all the water run through his fingers, and he says, nope, not going to heal him. Now, he's about to go back and let Dearmute know the news when his son, Oisin, and grandson, Oscar, demand that he go back and heal him. He says, you get your ass back there. You get that water and you bring it back here and heal Dearmute. Are you crazy? You know how awesome of a warrior he is. You know all the times he's helped you out. You're still holding this grudge that's just stupid. So he goes back and he says, yeah, you're right. You guys, you know, cooler heads prevail. He goes back to the river, brings back the water, but this time he's too late. All the messing around he did, Dearmute bled out and he died in his absence. Now, after his death, the god Angus takes his body back to the Burg, where he breathed life into it whenever he wished to speak with the hero. Now, this story has often been compared with an earlier love triangle between Deirdre, Noizu, and the king of Conchobar of Ulster, the exile of the sons of Ucilium, which is part of the Ulster cycle. But interestingly enough, this is the way that things worked out for Dearmute. He is killed. His destiny is fulfilled. He is killed in the manner in which he was supposed to die in. He's also said to be the fountain, according to legendary tales, and according to the Clan Campbell in the Scottish Isles. Dearmute is the founder of the Scottish Clan Campbell. On the Campbell crest is a boar's head, which is supposedly a reference to Dearmute's geese and his death. Now, Dearmute's pretty popular as far as popular culture goes. In the Irish dance show in 1999, Dancing on Dangerous Ground, Dearmute is portrayed by a former Riverdance lead, Colin Dunn. In the Fire Emblem game series, there are two games, the fourth one and the fifth one, that Dearmute is one of the heroes in the list of characters, I believe, that are playable. He appears... The story of his affair is told in the movie Leap Year. He's appeared in a mobile game app called Tower of Saviors. He's also in the light novel and the anime adaptation of the light novel that was made in 2011, Fate Zero, as the servant Lancer wielding his two spears. So he's been pretty popularized. There's also a crater on Europa that's named after Dearmute, with many others named after Celtic figures. So as you can see, Dearmute's had a pretty lasting impact. Now, there is one other impact that some people are probably not going to give Dearmute's story credit for impacting, that I think should be noted, and that is its connection to the Arthurian legends. For those of you who are familiar with the Arthurian legends, you know that there is a incredibly famous love triangle in them. One of the most famous, most iconic love triangles of all time. It's been portrayed in film, it's been portrayed in poems, it's been portrayed in literature for years, for centuries, and that is the love triangle between Lancelot, Guinevere, and King Arthur. Yes, this story is one of the foundational stones, one of the earlier sources that is pointed to as being a precursor, a massive, massive precursor to the story of Lancelot, and a precursor to the death of Arthur, La Morte de Arthur. Because there is tremendous overlap between these stories. And as you can see, it does result in the death. The only thing, the one thing that is different in terms of the pursuit of Dearmute and Graham, as far as it goes with Lancelot and King Arthur, is that Arthur dies in La Morte de Arthur, not Lancelot. And that's one thing that's particularly different about it. But other than that, the stories are remarkably similar. The knights in the Arthurian legend either die because Lancelot's too good, or they let him go because they don't want to kill him. And it even splits the kingdom apart. And then you also see that similar overlap with Mordred as a character. So that Dearmute's actually really a noble character, and Mordred is not. But you can see where this story is definitely almost like a primary source for these other writers. They've read this story, they've heard this story, they've seen these documents, and they know this story. And it's also interesting that the sort of concept of a love triangle was such an entertaining thing for people in the Middle Ages, and it still remains a very captivating and compelling piece of storytelling even now. You know, we went through the story, we kind of summarized it, but it remains a very captivating story. And not even just being a captivating story, but it shows that certain themes have great staying power in our society. And tragedy and romance are not going anywhere as far as the entertainment business goes. Now, if you're interested in learning a little bit more about this, you can get The Pursuit, Dearmute and Graham, printed now. And there's a copy of it edited and translated, I believe, by Mary Jones. You can also get the Dictionary of Celtic Mythology by James McAlop. And this is also considered to be a direct influence on the story of Tristan and Isolde as well, another tragic romance story of a famous warrior and a famous woman. Many people have suggested that Diarmuid and Grain have influence on Tristan and Isolde. You can look at Gertrude Schoeperle's Tristan and Isolde, A Study of the Sources of the Romance. But these stories are quite fascinating. And if you're not familiar with Tristan and Isolde, and you just don't feel like reading the story, which I mean, blame you for, but it is a fascinating story as well. Here's a brief summary, and you can see why it kind of overlaps with this story as well, is that Tristan is a young heroic knight. He falls in love with the Irish princess Isolde while escorting her to marry his uncle Mark of Cornwall. They begin an affair behind Mark's back. They're discovered. Their adventures take on more, and from there, their adventures take on more similarities to the Irish story, including an episode in which the lovers stay in a secret forest hideout. He has similar relationships with the knights. He has to do all this funky stuff, they get into these discussions about whether or not they're going to kill him, and they say, Tristan, we're going to let you go, man. We're just going to let you go. One of the other things that I think we can all learn from this is incredibly fascinating about these stories is not only the staying power that they have, but some of the themes that stay alive in these stories is fate. Fate is a huge theme that exists in a number of stories, not just medieval stories, but even now you look at these stories. One of the things I mentioned earlier before we went to commercial break was the idea that a hero to die, to really... For the story to end, right? The story can't really end without the hero's death. And one of the things that I would say to that is that's what makes the story compelling. And one of the things that some people would argue, and what I'm going to argue right now, is that is the hero really a hero if they don't ever die? I think that it's really hard to say that a hero isn't a hero if they don't ever die, but I think that the greatest heroes are the heroes who do meet their fate. They confront it, and even though they don't win, they're still heroes. And that's what I think makes the most compelling hero. The greatest heroes in literature and the greatest heroes that we have culturally are the heroes that didn't survive, the heroes that died. So you look at Achilles. And why he has such staying power? Why is Achilles the popular hero that he is? What is it that gives him that staying power? Why is the Iliad so incredibly popular? And you say, well, I've never even heard of the Iliad. It's the story of the Trojan War. Why was Troy such a smash hit when it came out? Well, it's because of Achilles, because he's very human, but he's also heroic, right? He's brave. He's chivalrous. He can get things. He's a guy that, he kicks ass, takes names, but he's also very human. He's got a weakness. That weakness is exploited. You're not happy that Achilles dies. In fact, most people, when you listen to the story of Troy, or you watch the movie, or you listen to the Iliad, or you read the Iliad, people are angry at Paris. They're angry at him. They're not even angry at Achilles. Remember that throughout the entire story of the Iliad, Achilles kills guys like no tomorrow. Same thing with Diarmuid. We look at Diarmuid, he basically killed 3,400 guys in the span of 7 hours just because he wanted a cup to heal this chick that he just met. And then he doesn't even stay with her. He leaves her. He killed all those guys and then doesn't even stay with the chick. Talking about the story of Diarmuid, is he not a hero? He did terrible things, but yes, he is a hero, right? Because he is doing this noble thing, right? He's going out. He's trying to retrieve the cup. He knows that it's the only way to heal this girl. And then on top of that, he is a hero. He is doing these errands for his king. He's going out and escorting his king to places. He protects Graham. Even though she's a pain in the rear, he protects her. even though she's compelled him in a sneaky way to get him to do what she wants him to do, he escorts her out of there. He sticks with her to the very end. The man killed a giant because she got hungry. If that's not heroic, I know some girls that get mad when they get hungry. I get mad when I get hungry. I know a lot of people that get mad when they get hungry. But I don't know anybody that's killed a giant for me so that I could eat. Some heroic stuff right there. That's the stuff of legends. This guy picked up a tree and murdered a giant so that his girlfriend could get something to eat. So you look at the deeds of Diarmuid. He does these things. He is very heroic, and I think what makes Diarmuid a real hero, like makes him a hero more than anything else, is that he knows his fate. And you know that he knows. And that's what makes Achilles such a great hero as well. That's what makes these heroes heroes. And that's what I think the disconnect for us now with heroes is. Now we look at heroes and they're there to entertain us. They're not so much there anymore to inspire us. They're not really all that inspiring. It's really awesome when we see Superman, you know, beat up General Zod, or we see Batman beat up the Joker, but, you know, or even Deadpool or any of these heroes that are out there. You know, it's cool to see Wolverine go crazy and murder a bunch of, you know, other bad guy mutants and watch Spider-Man beat up Venom. That's always cool, right? There are qualities in those characters that are heroic, but they're nothing like the scale of these guys. What separates them from these epic heroes, from these tragic heroes, what makes them, to me, less heroic is that they persist. They continue. Their story does not end. And in some cases, their story does end, but their characters are recycled. They keep coming back. There's an attempt to keep this idea of the hero alive, to perpetuate it, to keep it going, to keep it moving forward, to push it forward, to give us heroes, to give us something to aspire to, when all along these guys mastered it. You look at what these guys in the Middle Ages and the period before the Middle Ages, you know, the Hellenistic periods, you look at these times of storytelling, and these guys, they locked it down. They mastered how to tell the story of a tragic hero. I'm going to give this guy the ability to be a world-class ass-kicker, and then I'm going to give him a weakness. And that weakness will be exploited at this opportune moment. There will be a moment where the character comes to the realization that it is end game. It's over. You're done. You're going to die at this moment. And what's even better is that in many cases, these characters know the moment of their death. In the case of Achilles, you know, unlike Diarmuid didn't really know exactly when he was going to die. He knew what could kill him, which is different. He knew what his fate was going to be. He knew what was destined to kill him was that boar. That boar was destined to kill him. But he didn't know when it was going to happen. He didn't know where it was going to happen. He just knew that a boar would kill him and that he had to stay away. And basically, if he wanted to live, he just had to stay away from big pigs. But it was destiny. It was always going to happen. It was always going to line up to that moment where he was going to die. And the moment was made perfect. He didn't have the proper means to defend himself in that life and death struggle. Better way of saying that was fate was prepared for him. It was ready for him. It made ready the scenario so that he could meet his death. Now, if you look at Achilles, kind of like Diarmuid, very, very powerful guy, strong, charismatic, beautiful, but tragic. He's cursed. Achilles knows from the moment he steps on his boat to go over to Troy, from the moment he takes those little steps onto the boat, he knows he's a dead man. His mother was half goddess. His father was a god. We're not really sure. His father was an ancient king. But he's prophesied to. He's told. He's given a prophecy. If you stay here, you're going to live. Everything's going to be fine. You'll have a family. You know, they'll remember you, and so on and so forth. And then eventually your name's going to pass around to the ages, just like everybody else. You'll be like everybody else. But if you go to Troy, You'll be the greatest hero the world has ever known, but you're going to die. It's guaranteed. It's set in stone. You're going to be a dead man. It is going to happen. You will die. If you go to Troy, you're dead. And he gets on that boat anyway. Now, there's a multitude of reasons on why he gets on the boat. He's, you know, you can say he's arrogant. You can say he doesn't believe he's going to die. You can say whatever you want about why Achilles gets on the boat. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what Achilles' motivation for doing what he did is. What matters is that Achilles knows that he will die when he gets on that boat. He knows, whether it's in the back of his mind, it's still there. The knowledge that he will die is there. He is going to die when he gets to Troy. It could be the first day. It could be the last day that he's there. It could be the first day that he arrives. He could step off the boat, get shot right in the face. He has no idea what day he's going to die. He just knows that once he gets off the boat at Troy, that's it. He signed his death warrant. He didn't really fully believe it. It's in the back of his mind. This is the place where I will die. And Diarmuid is in the same situation. He's told that his father incurred the wrath of a god and that a boar is going to kill him. He's told that. You're going to die. This is what's going to kill you. You don't know when it's going to happen, but this is guaranteed. Your encounter with this creature is going to cost your life. The man killed a giant. Clearly he knew. Now you might say, well, he was... because he knew that, maybe it's because he knew this that he was able to kill all these other things. And that could be true. Maybe because he knew what ultimately would kill him, he had no fear of everything else that he had to fight. But in the end, it doesn't even matter what his Diarmuid's real motivation for performing these tremendous acts of valor and courage that he performs and being honorable. These things, you know, trying to preserve his honor and the honor of his friends, these things, his motivation for doing these things isn't as important as the fact that he does so knowing that fate is going to claim him, that one day he will be dust. One day he's going to encounter a pig. Could be when he's making one in the woods. He's a dead man. And you have to know that when Diarmuid was told, we're going on a boar hunt, he knew he was going to die. He knew he was a dead man. He still goes. He still goes to this boar hunt. And I think that's what makes Diarmuid really so heroic, is that he is very aware of what his destiny is. He's very aware of what his fate's going to be. But he doesn't shy away from his fate. He embraces it. He embraces it, and he lives a vibrant life full of adventure. And doesn't cry about it. He just embraces it. He just takes it in stride. And when the day comes, when he dies, there's a chance that he could be saved even. There was a chance that Achilles could have been saved too. There's often a chance in these stories for the hero to be saved. But circumstance doesn't allow it. We call it circumstance. We call it the choices of other people. But really, in the end, it's the same thing it was the entire time. The same thing from the beginning of the story to the end. It's fate. It's destiny. They were destined to die in that moment. They were destined to become immortal through death in that very moment. And it doesn't matter what their motivations were up to that point. What matters is how they met their fate. That's what makes them a hero. They are not immortalized in the same way that heroes now are immortalized. They don't have the luxury of issue number two. There won't be another story of him. This is his story. This is his story. And he had to live out his story to the end, whenever that end came, whether it was chapter one, chapter two, that's it. His story arc ends. You don't see, that's unique, and that's what makes Diarmuid such a hero in comparison to these other heroes we idolize so much today. These guys are real heroes, more so real than these superheroes that we have now, who are supposed to put forth these great things. We're supposed to follow these great moral codes, these high values that we have in society. They represent sort of these the heightened qualities of what we look for in our society, the good values we look for. But them go. In the same way that these people before us that wrote stories could let these people go. And I think the major reason why we can't let these heroes go, we can't let Superman go. We tried to let Superman go. We even killed Superman in a comic, and we had to bring him back. And some say it was the popularity, it was the sorrow, the outrage, or just the money machine that brought him back. But I think there's something deeper to it than that. I think ultimately there's two reasons why we can't kill our superheroes now permanently. And I say that now, people are going to say, well, they just killed off Logan. They just killed off, Wolverine. But did they really kill him off? Because they're already talking about another X-Men movie with Wolverine in it. They're going to redo this whole new story arc with a new Wolverine. They're already talking about it. They've been talking about it ever since they killed him. Go with these heroes. What is it that keeps us reviving our heroes? Why can't we kill our darlings? I think ultimately there's two reasons why. Number one, I think part of it is the money machine. Part of it is the money machine. These stories were written in a time where these people didn't write these stories because they were going to get rich writing them, for the most part. Later on, people did think they could get some money out of these. But ultimately, these stories are told to teach lesson, to inspire people, to entertain. But not in the same sense as they are now. There was a deep meaning behind these epic tales of these epic heroes, these larger-than-life heroes that exist in mythology. There was a deeper meaning, a grander lesson that can be learned in each one, a sense of morality, a sense of purpose and honor and dignity in these stories that people sought and looked for and they were hungry for more of. So it's not compelled by the same drive. The second reason I think we can't let go of our heroes in comparison, we can't just kill our heroes the way these old writers used to do it, is that we're afraid we can't come up with anything better. We're afraid of what happens when we kill Superman or Batman or Spider-Man or Wolverine. We're afraid of what happens when that hero dies. We don't want to see that hero die. We don't want to let go of them. If we let go of them, we have to let somebody else take their place. And if we let somebody else take their place, we have to question whether or not they were a hero. We have to question the validity of their tale. We have to question how valuable they were. And we don't want to quantify how valuable they were as a hero. We want to be entertained. We want to be fed. We want that hero to keep on trucking. We want them to be challenged, but ultimately we want good to win. We don't want there to be a shadow of doubt that good might not win, that bad things will happen and equal the scales. We don't want that. In the superhero movies we have today are completely different from these stories. They're not like the epics of old. There can't be the tragedy at the end. We can't have a conclusive tragedy within the hero world. Within the superhero model. And because we can't have that, the reason we cannot have that, is because we ultimately, at our core, don't want to believe for a single second that good does not always triumph over evil. We don't want to believe it for a single moment that darkness can steal over light. We don't want that to happen. In our minds, good has to win the day. It has to win. Evil can't win. We can't allow it. In our minds, we can't conceive that evil could win. We can't even conceive that good might not be good. We can't wrap our minds around that. We don't want to see into the minds of the villain. We don't want to see into the minds of them very much. There are some, there's some exceptions here and there. Some villains are pretty entertaining, and we do want to see into their mind a little bit, but can't let go of these heroes. Because of these things, we don't want there to be a single shred of doubt that they're a hero. We need them to be that hero and to win. It's okay if they struggle. It's okay if the bad guy's really, really strong. but the bad guy has to lose. We've got to maintain the illusion that everything is going to be okay. That is what our superheroes, that's why they're not heroes. Superheroes are not heroes. Superheroes are security blankets. That's what they are. They're different than these epic heroes. They're not the same as these guys. Heroes like Achilles, like Diarmuid, like Ajax, these ancient heroes are heroes. The Siegfried, the Sigurds, the Gunnars, the Ragnars, these guys are actual heroes. They may be larger than life characters, the Lancelots, the Arthurs. They may be larger than life. They may be too good. They do have an end. They do have a purpose. And ultimately, they are confronted with a fate they cannot outrun. They cannot escape. And the reason that they're actually heroes is because they meet that end with dignity. They meet that end with courage, with all the good trimmings that we value. But they do end. And that's why they're heroes, and that's why superheroes are not actually heroes. Superheroes are security blankets. They give us that warm, fuzzy feeling inside that everything is going to be okay. But heroes, they put you in a state of disbelief. You must suspend your disbelief for real heroes. These heroes sacrifice themselves. Heroes sacrifice themselves to save what is precious. Whether that's a person, whether it's a number of people, whether it's values, whether it's a nation, it doesn't matter what they sacrifice for. The importance of a hero is sacrifice. And that's what separates the epic heroes, the real heroes, as I would call them, from superheroes. With quote marks, superheroes. Because superheroes don't truly have to sacrifice because they don't pay the ultimate price. The civilians in their movies pay the price. Everybody pays the price. But not superheroes. Not them. They don't pay the price. And a handful here and there that die, maybe. They pay the price. They're heroes. But they don't pay the ultimate price. They don't die and just disappear and end. Their story continues. Or there's another reincarnation of them and they continue on. So they don't really truly die and they don't truly face the price. They don't pay that ultimate sacrifice. And sacrifice is what makes a hero. Guys, I hope you learned a lot today. I hope you enjoyed it. And feel free to dispute what you think a hero is. You can feel free. We're going to be having a chance to talk about this all again on Friday, and I'm going to bring up this same conversation. Hopefully you guys will want to call in for it, but I hope you enjoyed the show. Friday, we're talking about Karna, the legendary hero of Hindu mythology. So hope you guys will tune in for that. That's all I've got for you today. Hope you enjoyed it. See you all on Friday, 5 p.m. Eastern Time.